You want to have regular one-on-ones with people. That's all about kind of opening up lines of communication, you know, give and receive feedback, coach them up, listen to them to understand what they need to thrive, and, you know, work on some various performance things and helping them get promoted. And then the third thing, which often gets talked about in one-on-ones, is career development. People want to grow.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Jason Evanish. Jason Evanish is the founder and CEO of Git Lighthouse. Git Lighthouse is a company that's focused on helping develop great leaders by enabling better one-on-ones. In this episode, we dive deep into one-on-ones. Why are they important? What's the difference between a good one-on-one and a great one-on-one? How do you know if your one-on-ones are effective? Right now, we're in a challenging period for engineering leaders. That's why I'm dedicating time to answer questions about engineering leadership. If you have questions about building and managing a newly remote team, email me at wes@woventeams.com and I'll help you out. Again, that's wes@woventeams.com so I can help answer any of your questions about growing and managing a remote team. And now, here's my conversation with Jason Evanish. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams. You said before that as managers, we got to get really good at just a few things. If we do that, we can be top 10% manager. What are some of those things that separate those top 10% managers?
When I started my business about 5 or 6 years ago, I went and talked to a bunch of really experienced managers. And I talked to a lot of not so experienced and struggling managers. And it was amazing the patterns I found where the really experienced managers all had the same habits. They all had different ways of doing it, but they all had the same set of habits. And the ones struggling, the root cause was either doing some of those habits wrong or not doing them at all. And so the three things that we found people really need to do is you need to start by building a foundation of trust and rapport with your team. If they don't trust you, they won't talk to you. They won't give you feedback. They won't be confident working with you. They won't have psychological safety if you know Google studies. That's the first thing. From there, you want to have regular one-on-ones with people. That's all about kind of opening up lines of communication, you know, give and receive feedback, coach them up, listen to them to understand what they need to thrive, and, you know, work on some various performance things and helping them get promoted. And then the third thing, which often gets talked about in one-on-ones, is career development. People want to grow. Your best people especially want to see a path forward. So whether that means, hey, we're a small startup and, you know, when we raise our next round of funding, we're going to need someone to be a manager. Let's talk about what that would look like in a year. Or you're at a big company and it's like, I want to move from L5 to L6. Whatever that conversation is, people often want to advance. They either want to find out how to make more money for their family, or they like the challenge and the metrics of advancing like a video game. Whatever the reason, people want to talk about that. And if they don't get that growth and that learning opportunities at work, they'll go and seek it another job, and maybe they'll come to you guys.
So I heard it is, number one, we got to have trust, psychological safety. Number two, feedback, probably through one-on-ones. And number three is career development. Did I get that right?
Yeah. So build rapport, trust, have regular one-on-ones with them to open all kinds of lines of communication to talk about all kinds of things. It's kind of a Swiss Army knife. And then, yeah, talk about their career and help them make regular progress on their career growth, whether it's learning in their existing role or talking about a promotion.
So let's talk about one-on-one. So the first one, I think it'd be tough for people to argue that they don't want people to trust them or we shouldn't talk about careers. Why are one-on-ones so important?
They're so important because there's just no other time to talk about so many things. Like, when do you otherwise find time to talk to your team members and say, hey, you seemed really upset last week in the meeting. Like, what happened? Or, hey, we really need to talk about this pattern I'm seeing in your work. You need to improve in this way. Or, when do you have time to just ask things like, what's the number one thing you change about how our team operates today? Or maybe you ask them about, hey, what meeting would you cancel that you feel like is a waste of our time? There's all these things you could talk about that are often like zooming out and looking at the big picture at work and get you out of the day to day. But talk about the things that really, really matter to your employee, whether it's their success and your team's success or improving their performance and letting them know when they're doing a good or a bad job. There's just no other place for that. And so the one-on-one becomes this pressure relief valve for all these sorts of things, you know, especially if you think about it, we're recording this during the coronavirus quarantine. And the interesting challenge with that is there's a lot of uncertainty around that. You know, on top of is this a pandemic? Is my grandparent going to get it and possibly pass away? Or, you know, what's going to happen with my kids who are home from school? There's also the economic impacts, which can create a lot of uncertainty. So things like a one-on-one right now can be huge for people to relieve some stress. Like, am I going to have a job in a month? You know, what happens to our fundraising plans? What happens with our company and the hiring and budget freeze that just went out? Is layoffs next? I'm really uncertain. A manager can really reassure people in a one-on-one in addition to let people know where they stand.
So one-on-ones, give me feedback, both directions. So the person gets better and I can make a better company. I love that. I love those questions you listed there. Those are way better than the questions I ask in my one-on-one. So I'm going to take some notes later.
Yeah, maybe we can help you out later.
We'll get to that. I love your questions for remote one-on-ones. So what does a great one-on-one look like? So it's like nuts and bolts, tactics, like length, frequency, where we do them.
So in an ideal world, every manager would have 1 hour a week for each of their direct reports to meet with them. In the real world, I realize that's not always possible. If you have a really big team, say you have 10 to 15 direct reports, that's just not possible. You'd spend more than half your time in these. But in an ideal world, that's where you start. And then what I think you can do is you can unpackage that and say, okay, when could I get away with meeting less frequently? Well, one is if you have a bigger team, meet less frequently. So maybe biweekly makes more sense. If someone's worked with you for a very long time, you have a great relationship, you know that they're the kind of person that if you're annoying them or they're upset, they will come to you. You can probably meet a little less often because they'll reach out if they need more. On the other hand, the people that like you should meet more frequently, even if everybody else is like only maybe once a month or something, brand new to the company, they need more support. They're going to have lots of questions. They may not even know where the bathroom is. They, you know, there's all kinds of things that could be happening in the onboarding experience. So you'll want to meet with them every week until they're comfortable, maybe for the first quarter or two, to make sure that they're just flying high and doing great, because there's so much money wasted if somebody onboards really slowly. Then the other side of it is if someone's underperforming, someone's struggling, you want to manage them up to improve or manage them out and say, hey, you know what? This isn't the right role for you. Either, hey, let's move you to this other team, or hey, you know what? Like, I think maybe it'd be better if you found a job somewhere else. But you should put in the effort first to improve them, and your one-on-one is the perfect time to do that. And so again, meeting more frequently means that every time I have a conversation, the loop is tighter on like, hey, I'm really glad we talked about these things, Tim, but you need to work on X, Y, and Z by next time. Well, if next time is a month from now, that's a lot of procrastination. Versus if I say, next week, we're going to be sitting right here again, going over these things, and I want you to work on these. Well, boy, is that going to light a fire under you and make you want to take action right away? And so we've seen over and over again, managers who invest a little bit more time and meet more frequently with people and are explicit about what they're going to do, you can turn around that underperformer, or you can say after 6 to 8 weeks, hey, I've been beating the drum for 6 weeks now and nothing's changed. Even the most stern HR department, if you have records of that conversation, is going to be able to say, you know what? You're right. You did put in the effort. Here's our formal performance improvement plan, or actually we can start working on laying them off. Let's put a package together for them.
I want to make sure there's one bit in there that I think I want to clarify. If you're having a cut, I understand that the people priority, so new folks first, definitely prioritize those folks, folks that need more help. It sounded like you said if you had to trade between frequency and length, you would rather go every 2 weeks and hold the hour, or if I'm trading between, I have an hour every 2 weeks, would you generally recommend 30 minutes once a week or 1 hour every other week?
I would say if you have an underperformer or a new person, then 30 minutes once a week is better just because there's more happening and you get that turnover or the repeated cycle better. But otherwise, you want to have an hour. Andy Grove calls these things zingers, which is basically the idea if you have something really hard that you want to bring up with your manager, you know, maybe you're thinking about leaving, maybe something happened and they didn't notice, but you're really upset about it, or there's something that, you know, you have to deliver some bad news, you know, maybe you're not in trouble, but you still got to report some bad news to them. Those are called zingers. And as Andy Grove put it really well in High Output Management, if you get only one thing from the podcast, go get that book. It's amazing for leaders. He talks about zingers in that people, it takes time to have the courage to bring those up. And so by having an hour, you're much more likely to have them get warmed up in the conversation, talk about a couple of things with you, and then drop the hammer, so to speak, and take a deep breath and go, okay, we need to talk about this thing, or I'm thinking about leaving. Like, whatever that is, people need time to warm up. And so if you only have 30 minutes, very often that could come up with like 5 minutes left in the meeting, and then what do you do? Versus if you have an hour, it's a very good chance that they'll warm up and they'll tell you with plenty of time to deal with the issue. Versus worst case scenario is you're sitting in the meeting with them. Your phone is now buzzing, meeting reminder, you got to go to the next meeting. And they're like, I think I'm going to quit. And you're like, oh my God, I have 5 minutes before I run to a meeting with my boss. And you just drop that on me. What do I do? So the hour ends up giving you that cushion to make sure when you have really tough topics to cover, you have enough time. And if your team surprises you, you may not know it's coming. It's a lot easier to end the meeting early at, say, 40 minutes, 35 minutes, 45 minutes, than it is to try and find 15 more minutes at the end of a 30-minute meeting if you're like a lot of managers where your calendar is crazy.
I think I didn't realize that. So you find that whenever you do one-hour meetings, it's not uncommon to end them in 35, 40, 45 minutes if you're kind of in a gotcha. So schedule longer, end it earlier, and have the time if you need it.
So I always try to make sure that my employee and myself have an agenda we bring to the meeting. I start with what they have. I have my list of things that I want to run down. If we get through all of it, including their stuff, and we're out of time, or we have plenty of time left, I'll say, hey, is there anything else you want to talk about before we go? I let it pause for a good minute or two. And if they say nothing, you're like, no, we're good. It's great. All right. We both get 20 minutes back. So it's safe to end early, of course, but it's so much easier to end 20 minutes early than it is to find 10 more minutes after a 30 minute meeting is up.
I'm going to go change the calendar and invite a bunch of one-on-ones after this. Cause that is very much true. I think I was nervous about, well, I think I normally have about 30, maybe 40 minutes of content. I don't want to spend the extra time, but yeah, you can always end early. That makes so much sense.
I mean, it's a good habit for any meeting. I picked this up at, I forget which company I worked at before, but we had a rule that was very strongly enforced by the founder. He was like, hey, meetings are very expensive. You have lots of people in them. So especially like group meetings, he was even like, hey, if we have everything wrapped up, we are not filling this time. Like if we have an agenda and we get through everything, he came from Amazon. He's like, if we get through the agenda and we've made all the decisions, we're ending early. We're not going to fill the time. And so like, I think I kind of absorbed some of that and brought that into the concept of one-on-ones. But yeah, it's just so much easier to end early and like have that culture is something that's helpful across all team meetings.
A habit I found myself sometimes slipping into with one-on-ones is using them for status updates. Why is maybe that not the highest priority use of a one-on-one?
That's a very common issue. And it's something I think a lot of managers run into because it's a safe thing to talk about with your team. And so I find there are two things that are why you want to avoid status updates in your one-on-one. The first is it's a bottleneck. It's super inefficient because let's say you have a team of 5 engineers working with you. If you talk about status with them one-to-one, that's 5 one-to-one conversations where you possibly need to relay information to other people on the team. So you become a bottleneck unintentionally and constantly have to relay information between people when you really probably would say to yourself, man, I wish Joe and Tina were in the room right now. They need to hear that. So part of it is you're wasting that. You're creating more overhead for yourself to communicate that. Now, the second part is that you're wasting the time because it's very easy to talk about projects you're excited about for a long time. I know when I get passionate and like I'm meeting with our designer on something, oh man, we could talk all day about like placement and our design theory. And I just get really excited about it and they do too. So you could fill the whole time if you're not careful. But there's so many other amazing things you can talk about in one-on-ones that you wouldn't want to spend that time just on status updates. Instead, if you can push those status updates into other meetings or even better, can you get the update by looking in the project management tool or can you get it with like a virtual stand-up in Slack or something like that? And so instead then what you want to do is you want to ask a bunch of different other kinds of questions that have no other place. Like you can get a status update a lot of places, but you can't get a lot of other things talked about in other places. So those are things like, again, working on the rapport and trust with a new employee or checking in on those things. You know, it's good to every once in a while just ask people how their kids are doing and things like that. It's talking about their career development because that takes time. First, you want to uncover what it is. Then you want to check in every handful of one-on-ones on those topics. It's giving and receiving feedback. When else are you going to coach them on things if you're noticing a pattern over time? You don't want to make it a separate meeting. You might freak them out when it's like, this isn't a super big deal, but you know, you could do better about this. Obviously, you want to improve your company. You want to improve your team. When else are you going to get a chance to do that except maybe if you do sprint retros, which is another good habit. You also just want to take the pulse on how people are happy. Are they still enjoying the work they're doing or are there tweaks you want to make when they get off this current project? And then obviously, if you have a remote team, there are other questions to talk about supporting how they're working, you know, in, you know, whether it's a coronavirus environment or they just permanently work remotely, having a chance to explore how their workflow and day-to-day is can be really powerful to make them more productive.
So I love the remote work topic you just mentioned, and your emotional savings account trust. So let's start with trust. What's important about trust, and how do I use one-on-ones to build it up?
Sure. So trust is obviously important for a few different reasons. One is, think about who you'd be willing to open up to if you had a problem. Somebody you trust, you're much more likely to give more detail. Someone you're afraid of, you're intimidated by, you don't really know, you're not going to open up as much. It's like, you know, most people aren't going to, you know, tell their sorrows to a stranger, but a friend or family member they'll confide in. Well, as a manager, you are either a trusted associate and someone who's there to advocate on their behalf and help them succeed, or you potentially are someone who is feared and you're intimidated by. And so as a manager, you want to break down that fear and create that psychological safety, which makes your team more collaborative, but also then collaborate better with you. So it's important for that foundation. And then over time, if you want to ask them questions and get them to open up, again, you need that trust foundation for them to be willing to do that.
And you use an emotional savings account metaphor. I really love that. Could you explain what that metaphor is like?
Sure. So the emotional savings account is this idea that you as a leader create these accounts with everyone on your team. That's this concept of trust that you have with them. As you do things that they appreciate, as you do things that they see that you're working on their behalf and towards their success, that all builds up the emotional savings account. They have more and more trust in you. Now, when bad things happen, you need to dip into that trust. You need to dip into that savings account so that they'll still believe in you. Right now, when you start talking about you may need to do layoffs or pay cuts or cut budgets, you need to be able to have them believe that when you say, hey, we're going to, you know, we let John go, but he's the only cut we're going to need to make. This makes it so we can survive for 9 months and we'll be fine to weather this storm. If you have a strong emotional savings account, they'll believe you. If you have an empty savings account, they will not believe you, and that may cause them to leave, not trust you, start looking out for number one more. All those sorts of things can happen. And so the more you can build that up, the more you can survive hard times, because people will trust you, because they're like, well, they've done all these other things, all these other actions, acting in good faith. I have every reason to believe them now. But you have to build up and make deposits early, because you never know when you're going to need it.
What are some things that we can do during our one-on-ones to make those deposits in the emotional savings account?
Sure. I mean, the first one is just to show you care about them as a human being. So you'll see that both in Gallup research, as well as some of Google's upward feedback surveys, they both look at things like, does my manager care about me as a person? It turns out that causes more engagement if you believe that your manager cares about you as a person, and that you can come to them with any questions related to work or not. And so the way you can build those up is to literally show you take an interest in them as a human being. You know, if they have kids, do you know their kids' names? Do you know how old they are? Do you know important things about them? You know, I know when I was growing up, I used to hear it all the time. If I came in my dad's office, my dad would proudly talk about my like cross-country career in high school. And, you know, now I have a bunch of friends who have little boys and girls as kids. And so, you know, it's amazing to watch them light up when you just let them talk for a minute or two about something about their kids. And so things like that can matter. Now, if people don't have kids, then it may be something about, you know, where they live or the trip they went on or a hobby they have that they're really excited about. You know, giving them a little bit of time to talk about something like that that's important to them and showing you care enough to ask can mean a lot. Other ways that you can do that is obviously if you advocate for them, if you protect them from drama and BS and politics in the company and they realize you're doing that. Again, that's another way that you can build some of that. Or if you do things to show loyalty or, again, stand up for them in a situation. You know, I've definitely seen a number of different times in the workplace when you see, you know, maybe someone's being an overbearing jerk and you stand up for your employee to them. You know, that obviously goes a long way. Or it's just simple things like saying, hey, I noticed X or Y, and I appreciate that. Recognizing and giving praise is another way that lets people know, hey, I'm watching and I appreciate what you're doing. All of those things make little deposits. Because the thing is that you make tiny deposits one by one to build up an emotional savings account. And unfortunately, usually when you're making withdrawals, they're rather large.
So small deposits, so we can make the big withdrawals when we need it. So folks are more remote now, so we're on a Zoom call. I want to talk about these zingers. Like, how do we extract zingers? That feels like a really subtle skill.
Yes. So one of the most important things a manager can learn to develop that's an underrated skill that doesn't get talked about a lot is body language. So if you can learn to read body language, it's so powerful. Because whether you're in a meeting or anything, this is one of the reasons I think a remote role is, especially early on, to use video, is because you want to see facial reactions. You want to listen for changes in tones and voice. You want to see, I'm leaning forward right now. If I was leaning back in a meeting and I have my arms crossed, like that's a bad sign. Somebody's not too happy. They're kind of checked out. So like learning to pick up on some of those signals is exactly what can help you as a manager kind of draw out the zingers where it's like, hey, Tamara, I saw in the meeting that you seem pretty closed off and upset. Like what happened? You know, or hey, it sounds like you're not happy with this change. You know, when I announced it to the team, I saw you did, you know, you seem like you reacted pretty negatively. I just love to understand what your concerns are so you can talk through them. So you come to it with an inquisitive tone, not judging. What do cops do? Interrogating. Yeah, you're not interrogating people. What you're doing instead is you're just trying to understand and you're looking for signals. And so a phrase I really like, I learned from a book called Nonviolent Communication, is you use phrases like it sounds like, it seems like, it looks like. And so when you say those things, it's no longer as, it's not you were checked out. It seems like you were checked out. It seems like you were frustrated, not I think you're frustrated. And so what it does is it allows room for misinterpretation. Oh no, I was just really tired. Really tired. What's going on? What made you tired? Oh, well, da da da. You know, my kids are keeping me up and like, you know, I'm working really late to make up for the fact that I got to watch my kids all day. You know, like there's just stuff like that that could be coming up. And so you end up going in a different direction, but finding out. But basically, if you look for these body language cues, you can often pick them up. Also, you can see tone in email and messages. Like my business partner knows when I'm getting frustrated. He sees it in my Slack messages before it shows itself any other way. And so we'll often have ad hoc phone calls. If he sees, oh, hey, you know what? You seem a little frustrated today. What's going on? We'll hop on a phone call and talk through something and everything's good. So learning to pick up on those signals, which may be different for each person on your team, can really help. And then just using things like phrases like it seems, it sounds like, it looks like, are all great ways to be like, hey, I think I'm seeing this, but I could be wrong. Correct me, but I'd like to investigate this. That's a way to kind of dig out a zinger from them just based on a natural body language reaction you may see.
So your business partner can pull zingers out of you over Slack. That's pretty impressive. What do you think he's, maybe what's the last time that happened, or what do you think he's seeing?
It's word choice. It's tone of words. I honestly, one of my weaknesses is I can get sharper with my words sometimes, especially with someone who's like a peer. It's not, like, I'm always like much more careful, I guess you could say, with people who report to me, but like someone who's like my equal, it's definitely sometimes a little easier to just like filter off. Like we're both the kind of people that are generally like very direct communicators, but he notices that like my words will get a little bit sharper with him, you know, when I'm a little bit frustrated. And so, and it's often completely unrelated. Like that's the funny thing is I won't even know that it's happening. And then it'll be, have nothing to do with the actual thing. Like it'll be, you know, my feedback on a Trello card for something he's working on will be a little bit sharper. And it's this other thing over here that is bothering me. And so that is, the signal is unrelated to the end result, but it helps. It's a trigger that helps him know there's something else we probably should talk about.
What are some of the sharp words you use that you might not use? I'm trying to get a picture of this.
I don't know off the top of my head, honestly.
So it's like, this is, you know, surely you don't say like, this is crap. So it's probably like, some, I'm trying to think, what's the like hierarchy of sharpness? I'm trying to think if I have these same words.
You know, yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, but like, it's definitely like, I think it's probably like sometimes being a little more diplomatic with like, you know, whether something's done or how, you know, one of the things like I love from Indra Nooyi, who is the CEO of Pepsi, is she's like, you know, you want to always assume positive intent with people. And, you know, then you'll give them the benefit of the doubt. It's like, I always like the analogy, like if you're in a crowded bar and a stranger bumps into you and you spill your drink, you're going to be really mad at that person. Like, hey, what the heck, jerk? But like, if your friend bumps into you on their way to the bathroom, like you're still going to be like, hey, why'd you do that? But like, you're going to be forgiving of them because you know them. And so that goes back to the emotional savings account, but it also goes from like stuff sometimes happens and you need to like figure out why.
Let's talk about remote one-on-ones. You had some you got some questions from a blog post that I have over here if you don't have the questions about remote habits as folks are switching into newer remotes. What are some questions maybe we could add to our one-on-ones to be better managers for our newly remote teams?
So I think there's two different kind of avenues to go down. So if you are brand new to remote and it's like coronavirus remote, which is like everyone's stuck working at home and you're remote for the first time, you haven't been doing it before, that presents some very, very specific challenges that are different from like the remote pro. Like there's an engineer I worked with at Kissmetrics who's been remote for years. So he has a whole system down. The things that he needs in a remote one-on-one are very different than the person who's like coronavirus, I'm remote for the first time, and I'm stuck working from home.
My kids are running around. My wife is also remote.
Yes, exactly. So we'll start with the coronavirus one, then we can talk a little bit about the long-term remote situation, which will also, depending on how long quarantine lasts, may apply to everybody. So if you're working with people who are in the corona situation, the first thing you want to talk about is routines. Because my normal work routine is I get up, I shower, I grab some breakfast, I head out the door, I get on the subway, I go to my office, I get to my office, I sit down and I work, and I work for a while, and I take a break in the office, and I work for a while, and then stuff happens, and then my day is over, and now I'm commuting home, and I get home. That routine, if you're working from home in the coronavirus scenario, is completely out the window. You know, you don't have anywhere to go. Your work hours are now ambiguous. Like you said, your kids may be at home bouncing off the walls. Your spouse may be in tight quarters. Like in New York City, like I'm lucky I have a nice one-bedroom apartment. But I know some people that are like sharing a studio with their spouse. And they're like, we sit on opposite ends of the bed. This is awkward. And so you can have these situations that are very difficult. So you want to talk about the routines. Hey, keep your routine. Pretend you're commuting, but then just open the laptop up or like read a book for 20 minutes if you want to warm your brain up. And then start working. The second thing is you want to talk about their workspace. Again, like if you're in that scenario where you're working on your bed, that's not a great idea. That's going to disrupt your sleep. It's going to get uncomfortable after a couple hours. It's going to be tough. You want to talk about, hey, what makeshift things can we do? Can we order something on Amazon Prime? So at least starting on Wednesday, you have something good. Talk about their workspace setup so that they both don't wreck their posture and can be productive without it hopefully ruining the rest of their life where like, I have found if you work in the same place, you try to relax, like literally like work on the couch and then watch a movie, either one of them's going to suffer. Either your work, you're going to have trouble focusing or you're not going to be able to decompress after. So you want to have a separate space. Like even with me, my couch is like 3 feet behind us, but that's enough where I'm sitting at a desk. It's a dedicated desk. There's a monitor right above and I can focus here. And I know when I'm sitting here in my chair, that's what I'm going to do. And when I'm on the couch, I'm chilling. That's enough isolation for me to be able to focus. So making sure people have a good setup is super important. You know, in the case of one of my friends who has the tiny studio, he turned his bookshelf into a standing desk and it helped tremendously. You know, little hacks like that can go a long way. And then the third thing to talk about in the coronavirus sudden remote scenario is talking about connection. So whether you do have a spouse to talk to or you're like me and I'm alone in a one bedroom right now, like having other human beings to talk to is super valuable, especially if you're an extrovert. And so making sure people take time to connect is super valuable and let them know it's okay. Hey, if you want to take 15 minutes to go talk to an engineer you're used to turning to your right and talking to every day, like that's okay. Like just you know, shoot the ish a little bit and like, you know, talk about what's going on. Like that's good. And then also, you know, for me, I used to be a product manager. I used to talk to all kinds of people all the time. I'd go talk to the VP of sales to see how they're doing. I'd go talk to customer success and find out what are the bugs we're hearing all the time. Replicating those conversations remotely requires intention. You don't pass them in the hallway. You don't see them in the kitchen when you're refilling your water bottle anymore. I don't see anybody when I do that right now. And so being intentional and saying, hey, Mika, like let's schedule a call to make up for the fact that we don't have our 15-minute hallway conversation anymore. Both will solve some of the loneliness issue and stir craziness, cabin fever you get, as well as make sure those lines of communication stay strong across your company.
So what I heard, we got 3 points there. We've got, we want to talk about routines, ask about routines, get detailed, give suggestions. We want to talk about workspace, make sure they have a separate place and they're not wrecking their posture. And then we want to talk about replicating the spontaneous communication we would otherwise get and making it deliberate and being okay with you know, time that's not explicitly work time or maybe it is.
Yes. Yeah, you need both. You should, with especially some of your peers that you would normally collaborate with by like turning the screen together, you want to replicate that. And then also have some of that social bonding time is super helpful. Just like you would have drinks in the office, like have the drinks equivalent. I've already seen a bunch of companies where they have like a Brady Bunch style screen on Zoom and everybody's got their own like glass of scotch or whatever they like to drink. And they're all having a group drink hangout. Like those social things are still important just as much as lines of communication between departments are.
So there's a lot of people who are listening to this that are already doing one-on-ones. There's an effect that we all think we're above average drivers, basically all of us. What are some signs that maybe we're not actually an above average one-on-one driver?
So I think one of the most easy and obvious ones is if somebody on your team leaves and it's a surprise, your one-on-ones are terrible because you should know it's coming. You should see that they're getting frustrated or that, hey, we tried to talk about the career growth they want and there's just nowhere to go in our company. You know, sometimes that happens where there just isn't a fit for what they want to do. So you know that there's like a timeline where they're going to leave or maybe they want to change careers. So there are times where it's okay that they're leaving. But whether it's good or bad that they're leaving, your one-on-ones is a time you should be getting in front of that conversation and be aware if they're thinking about leaving or you want to plant the seed because maybe they're not working out. That should all be happening in the one-on-one. So there shouldn't be surprises. So I would say the first sign and the worst sign is if somebody leaves and you're like, I didn't see that coming, then that's an obvious one in the one-on-one. I think lesser things then is just, you know, how much harmony or disharmony is there on your team? Because very often you can coach through a lot of issues and problems on your team in one-on-ones. So if you find that there isn't a lot of people on your team getting along or there's just a lot of frustration as a team as a whole, you're not using the one-on-one as the pressure relief valve it should be.
So other folks are not getting along. And if I'm using my one-on-one effectively, I should be able to let people vent or talk through their problems so that the result of a good one-on-one is harmony on the rest of my team.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are going to be conflicts. There's going to be times where you have to disagree and commit, but those things shouldn't be simmering and boiling over. Instead, you should be able to let people feel heard and then move on from it. So if you see you maybe made a decision and some people don't agree with it, if you talk about it in the next one-on-one and like really listen to their concerns in detail, you may find something you want to tweak and, you know, turn a couple of knobs that you have as control as a manager, not big changes, small changes that can make a big difference for them. You know, or maybe it's mediating an issue between two people, but you often, you know, for instance, when there's conflict between two people on your team, if it goes on for too long, people will start to take sides and it becomes gossip and drama. Versus if you kind of can take it head on and you talk to both of them and say, hey, now that we've talked about it, you two need to go go solve it directly together. You can mediate and coach that through a little bit to keep things working at least as best you can.
I like that. I like internal locus of control things. So I think it's easier for people to us as managers say like, oh, they just don't get along. I think you're right that we have some levers we can pull. And one-on-ones make a lot of sense.
It's amazing how often the things that I've done that have made people happiest have been the smallest things. You know, it's little things like who gets assigned a small task because it turns out one person loves to do them. And one person absolutely hates it. Like, I'm amazed how often that can work out. But if you don't listen, you don't find out what those are, you'll be assigning something that somebody wishes they could do is now assigned to the person that hates it. You have two people that are upset now versus you can make two people really happy by making a simple switch on even a small task. And then other times it's just like finding small things like, oh, well, I mean, we've always done it that way, but we don't have to do it that way. I didn't know anybody didn't like it. Like there's so many things like that, that if you just start to force having those uncomfortable conversations, you can fix a lot of things and pay down what I like to call management debt, where it's just like little things that are like, oh, that's bothering someone. It means nothing to me and costs me nothing to change. You should just change it. And then you get your team in that habit of knowing that if you do take the time to open up to me about that, we might actually do something about it. That is just huge for making people feel relieved and trust you that they can keep coming to you with suggestions and issues and ideas for improving things where it's maybe even just like, this doesn't bother me that much, but like you do realize that everybody on the team feels this way about X and you're like, no, I didn't. Now I do. Or now I'll go ask everybody else to confirm it and let's do something differently about it.
It's like, you know, when there's a virus of discontent spreading and we don't run any tests, we don't know. And then we have our one-on-one tests and this analogy is falling apart, but.
No, you're right. If you don't talk about it and you don't test for it, it can keep spreading and get worse and worse until you have to take more drastic measures to resolve it.
quarantine our whole team, I guess. That's kind of, I guess I've seen teams like that where two people just like stop talking. So you have to like make your team work with kind of a half split in the middle because two people won't get along. And that also hurts your economy.
Yes, or somebody leaves. And now you have to fill the role versus like if we could have just worked it out and figured out what your issues were, you know, that could work. Or sometimes you need to isolate, but do it in a more productive way. Not these two people who are on the same project hate each other and they have to work together. And now the project's crap because they can't work together. Instead, you're like, you know what? Like they're not getting along right now. Let's give them some breathing room. Let's assign them tasks that are isolated from each other. And we're going to work through this knowing that they will work together again in the future. But for now, let's quarantine them. And let's reduce the friction while we cool it off a little bit. And then we'll, you know, keep in mind, and I'm going to, as a manager, dig in and understand why they're not getting along. And you may find out that, like, it's related to some behavior or habit you can coach one of them up on. Or you can say, well, if I don't assign Jeremiah this kind of task, it won't upset, you know, this other person on the team because they like it done a certain way. But they can do these other 95 tasks. Like, why would you give them that one task that you know they do it in a way that bothers this other person? You know, there's a lot of really dumb reasons why people like start out not getting along. And then like it's very easy to become entrenched. And so you as a manager, your job is to sniff those things out, get to the root cause of them, and then like help everyone act like adults again and like sort it out.
So some of us are managers. We have a manager and we have direct reports. So what do we do if our boss maybe isn't taking some of this advice about running a good one-on-one?
I think taking control of your one-on-one is one of the best things you can do, whether you have a good or a bad boss. So a good boss will greatly appreciate you making their life easier. Because let's face it, sometimes you'll manage, especially this happens in engineering, you have somebody who's an introvert who can really clam up and it's like pulling teeth to get anything out of them. And so it's very difficult to manage them successfully. That can be really exhausting as a manager. And so I know in my experience, when I have somebody who will make my life easy and come with an agenda every week and tell me when I'm bothering them, tell me when something's bothering them and come to me with ideas without me having to always prompt it, like I love those people. Like they're like, yes, thank you. Thank you so much. I try to be fair to everybody, but thank you for making my life a little bit easier. So whether you have a good or a bad manager, it's really going to help if you take the time to think about, what do I think I need to be successful? What's bothering me that I think my manager might be able to help me with? What ideas do I have to improve the team? If you can actually volunteer some of those things to your manager, they're going to appreciate it. Now, if you have a bad manager, there's a few extra things you'll want to do. If you have a bad manager, not only are you going to want to bring those things to them, but you're going to nudge them on it. So like you may talk about it and they're like, yeah, you know, that's a pretty good suggestion. Maybe we should do that. You should then take the initiative and say, great, how are we going to do that? What can you or I do to make that move forward? And really push them to take the time to write it down and say, cool, you're going to do this. I'm going to ask you next week about it. So like, can you make a note right now? So you definitely do it. You know, it's an aggressive form of managing up, but it's a way to make sure that if you bring something up and it's important, you tell them, hey, I'd really appreciate if you write that down and do this before we meet next time, because this is really important to me. Can you please do that? Like being super explicit with your ass with a bad manager is a great way to probably get a little bit more of what you want. And frankly, if you get to the point where a manager won't even do that, then like you should probably think about, can I transfer to another team, or can I live without that thing, or should I warm up my resume?
My guest today has been Jason Evenish. Jason, thank you for joining us on Scaling Software Teams.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
Thanks again to Jason for sharing his experience with us. Here are a couple of takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, there are three things that separate the top 10% of managers from the rest. The first is establishing trust. It takes real investment to understand a person, get to know them, show that you care. And folks that put this effort in to establish trust are better managers. Number two, one-on-ones are for building trust, not for giving status updates. If the goal is to just get a status update, there are more efficient ways to do that. We can do this async. We can use project management tools. The job of a one-on-one is building trust and giving feedback. Our one-on-ones are the place for an employee to give us feedback when there's a problem. That allows us to help them succeed. Think about who you'd be willing to open up to if you have a problem. Is it your manager? If not, maybe your one-on-one with them could be more effective. And then switch the problem. Do you think your employees come to you with problems that are hairy? Number three, Remote one-on-ones are different, and that's okay. If you're brand new to remote, let's talk routine first. Our normal work routine is probably broken, so what do we do now? How do we keep ourselves sane? After we've talked about our routine, let's talk about our workspace. Things like posture, comfort, focus, and productivity. We can also use these one-on-ones as a time to make sure folks are connecting with one another. This is especially important if we're managing extroverts. Thanks again to Jason for coming on the show. Now, I want to hear from you. If you have any questions about growing a remote team, please email me at wes@woventeams.com. I read every email personally, and I'm excited to talk to you about your problems. Until next week, keep on scaling.